I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to talk to Michael Bart, who wrote a book called Until Our Last Breath, a Holocaust story of love and partisan resistance. And there are many pieces of Holocaust literature in the world, but not many talk about the resistance of Jews in Europe during the Holocaust. We hear a lot about concentration camps, the 6 million who died, the 11 million altogether who died in the camps, but there were lots of Jews and others in Europe who resisted Nazis and fascism and fought back. And Michael Bart realized that was his family and wrote this book, Until Our Last Breath. And Michael Bart, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Your father was a partisan, as was your mother, who fought the Nazis out of a ghetto called Vilna in what is now Lithuania. So talk about your – for a minute before we get into the heart of this story and history and who your parents were. Talk a bit about your journey into this book and being the son of those two parents.
Well, basically, when you are the son of Holocaust survivors, you have either felt or heard the Holocaust your entire life. You either – if your parents didn't speak much, you felt it. If they did speak a lot, you heard it. My parents didn't speak that often about their Holocaust experiences, with two exceptions. My mother spoke about being born and raised in what's today Vilnius, Lithuania. She calls it Vilna. And my father spoke very often about his being a member of the Partisans of Vilna with Ava Kovner and the Avengers unit, because he was really proud of his accomplishments. And that was really the basis of what they spoke to me about. In the last 2 years of my dad's life, and from 1994 to 1996, with my dad in failing health and my mom not as strong as she was, they started sharing some more details with me. But what really changed everything for me was something that happened at my dad's funeral in 1996. After we had lowered the casket and everybody had thrown in their dirt and people were milling around, a man went up to me, and he didn't identify himself, and he said, "Michael, you need to inscribe Freedom Fighters of Nakama on your parents' gravestone." And I didn't know what he was talking about. And I said, "Could you repeat that?" He just goes, "Freedom Fighters of Nakama." Then a short time later, somebody called my name, and I turned for a second to see who was calling me. And then when I turned back to get clarification, he was disappeared into the crowd of mourners. And at that time, I was distracted with other things. But, you know, it was something I was thinking about. And then what happened is, a few days later, I was going through my dad's personal possessions at home, and I found some things that he had from the war, and I found a bunch of documents that was talking about his partisan resistance group, and I realized the name of their group was Nakama, or Avenge or Revenge in Hebrew. And so that day at his funeral changed my life, because then I spent the next 10 or 11 years researching people and organizations all around the world to get I had a good basis of to work with from what they told me and then documentations they left me, but I had to basically put it all together, and that took me about a good 10 years.
Talk a minute about your parents and who they were and their story out of Vilna.
Well, my father was born in a small town in Poland, and he escaped in 1939, right after the Germans invaded. And what he did is he went with a bunch of members of his Zionist group. He was a member of the Shomer Hatzair Zionist group, which was a left-leaning Zionist group. But a bunch of his members, they went and they got to Vilna, which at that time, based on the non-aggression pact signed by the Germans and the Russians, was under Russian control. And even though it wasn't lovely living under Stalin, it was a lot better than living under Hitler. And so he had gone to Vilna with the hope that he and other members of his group could ultimately go to Palestine and get out of Europe, because they realized there's no hope in future in most of the countries for the Jews in Europe. My mom was born and raised in Vilna, came from a, I'd say, middle-class to upper-middle-class family in Vilna, where my father came from, a very poor family. And she was just graduating high school when all the action happened in 1941, when the Germans broke the non-aggression pact and invaded the Soviet Union. And 2 days later, they were in Vilna.
And how'd they meet?
They met in a crazy way. They were having a Zionist meeting within the, once they were forced into the ghetto. And a lot of people think...
By the Russians or the Nazis?
By the Nazis.
By the Nazis.
And a lot of people think a ghetto was just an area where Jewish people lived. Well, it's a lot different than that because they were forced into an area where before there were maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people, 5,000 people living, and all of a sudden 35,000 went in. And they were forced, and they were eating very little food. They were it was very, very tough. And then they were little by little, the Germans were taking out members of the ghetto and killing them because they ultimately wanted a smaller ghetto. Well, my father went to a Zionist meeting within the ghetto, and my mom's cousin was a member of the same group. My mom was not, but my mom happened to be there, and they met by coincidence, and then my mom's cousin introduced them in the ghetto.
So your mom met this, I guess, dashing young Jewish radical Zionist?
Well,
is that what happened?
Well, my mom told me it was kind of...
well, the other way around, was it?
Well, my mom says that she met my dad, and, you know, when she introduced my father to her mother and grandmother, my dad says it was the most traumatic thing. He goes, that was worse than fighting the Nazis. And he goes, because, number one, the Yiddish that was spoken in Vilna was a Litvak Yiddish, and it's kind of like the gold standard, where he came from Poland and he had a little bit different dialect, number one. Number two, he had no education, because in his hometown after the eighth grade, there's no more education. He didn't have any money. He didn't have any family. If this is somebody my mom's going to bring home to meet the family, it's kind of like, well, this is, you know, it was very traumatic for my dad. He said that it was very quiet for a while. But they met in the ghetto. They became friends. A romance developed, and they ultimately got married in the ghetto by one of the last remaining rabbis 90 days before the ghetto was liquidated.
And we should say, you mentioned Yiddish. For people who don't know, Yiddish was the Jewish language of Eastern Europe and Russia, based around German but written in Hebrew characters. It was that was what most Jews spoke, and there were different dialects of it around Europe.
Exactly.
It's interesting. I when I was thinking about that, when your parents meeting, that there's, in the midst of whatever horror can exist, Nazis ghettoizing Jews and then slowly but surely killing off the Jews of the ghetto and wiping them out, even in the midst of all that horror, that love can still take place.
Absolutely.
that's part of the beauty that comes out of the madness sometimes.
Well, I basically made contact with 41 different people, mostly survivors, who helped me with bits and pieces of this. And one of them I went up to because most people want to talk about the partisan resistance, blowing up trains, killing Germans. That's to most people, that's more interesting. But I went up to a lady who knew my mom, and she's a Holocaust survivor, knew her very well. And I said, tell me some things that will be helpful for me and just give me some information. And she said to me, Michael, there's only one thing you need to know about your parents, only one thing. And I looked at her thinking, oh, this will be interesting. And she says, your parents are a love story. You don't need to know anything else. Nothing else matters. Your parents are a love story. And when she said that, I felt like I would be knocked over, because she was so emphatic, where everybody else was telling me about partisan experiences and what they were doing. This person just focused on love story.
Well, before we get into the partisan part of this for your book, talk a bit about that. I mean, because most of us, no matter who our parents are, don't think of our parents as a love story. I mean, some of us have learned our parents' love stories, but talk a bit about this love story.
The love story thing is interesting, because my father was very shy and my mother was very naive. And she told me that she was so naive when she had a perception that she could never kiss a boy, she'd get pregnant. She told me she literally thought she could get pregnant. And then I know how shy my dad is. So it's really hard for me to imagine. But, you know, my mom used to joke about, you know, she was a little bit more assertive than my dad was. He needed, you know, my dad would grin. So I don't know if he was denying it or acknowledging it. But it's really kind of hard for me to imagine. A lot of people don't realize, when the Germans decided to put all the Jews in a ghetto, there were about 70,000 Jews in Vilna. And the Germans initially, in a larger and a very small temporary ghetto, only wanted 35,000 Jews. So what happened to the other 35,000? And the answer is the Lithuanians were collaborating with the Germans in Vilna. And what they were doing is they were basically taking Jews, and originally it was mostly men, out into the fields, out into the forest of Ponari, about 4 miles away from Vilna, and there were these large pits that were dug by the Russians for oil, and they were shooting them. And so ultimately, and they were doing it under the orders and they were doing it for a lot of reasons. One, they wanted to make points with the Germans, thinking the Germans would give them their independence and they could get away from their hated Soviet Union. Number two, they were fundamentally anti-Semitic, so it wasn't that difficult for them to do, and so it was an economic opportunity. And so they basically killed and shot roughly about 35,000 of the Jews of the from Vilna. Then what happened is when the ghetto was formed, the Germans really only wanted to have maybe 15,000 Jews in the ghetto, and they originally started with 35. So they were having these roundups with them and their Lithuanian collaborators where they were taking Jews out of the ghetto, they were taking them out to Ponari, and they were shooting them. So the majority of the Jews in Vilna were not killed by the Germans. They were killed under the Germans' instructions. They were killed by the Lithuanians. And when they got into the ghetto, the average Jew was getting about 400 calories a day in food, and which was usually a bowl of soup and a piece of bread. It was just enough where they could survive, but enough where they were miserable. And they were working 6 days a week, long hours. They were working hard, and they were trying to keep from getting caught up where they would be taken away and killed. So life in the ghetto, initially, my mother in her room was living with 25 people in one room. Literally, they were sleeping end to end to end to end because that's how crowded it was. Eventually, it got a little better. So life in the ghetto was really bad. And that was one of the things that my parents didn't talk much about. And I had, growing up, I thought, well, a ghetto is like a Jewish neighborhood. Well, it's hardly a Jewish neighborhood. It was really bad.
So one of the stories I think that some of us always thought about was that we knew that millions of Jews were sent to concentration camps. 6 million died in those camps. 11 million people altogether, and 6 million of those people killed were Jews, as the Germans tried to annihilate Jews off the face of the earth, among others. But there was a group of Jews in those ghettos who ended up resisting and fighting back. And the Warsaw Ghetto is maybe the most famous in America of an uprising against the Nazis. But the Vilna uprising, the partisans that your parents were part of, that fought physically against the Nazis and the Lithuanians, was probably the largest, most important of those groups that fought the Nazis, that came out of the ghettos. To talk a bit about that, I mean, you tell this incredible story here about the young men. I'm looking at the young poet who was the leader of the
Abakovner.
Abakovner. Right.
Well, okay, in the Vilna ghetto, there were two underground groups that ultimately merged. But the fundamental ideological difference was one a group was called the FPO, and one of their leaders was Abakovner, and the other was Yitzhak Wittenberg and Joseph Glassman. And their goal is they wanted to do their families were from Vilna, and that they wanted to do a Warsaw Ghetto thing. They figured, let's just die with dignity. Because most of the people in Vilna, specifically the partisans and resistance leaders, felt that they were not going to live the war. They were not going to live the war. There was another group led by Yehiel Scheinbaum, and his group, they basically wanted to escape to the forest. They didn't have family in Vilna. Most of them were refugees that came from other cities. Ultimately, the two groups merged. And Abakovner wanted to have a Warsaw Ghetto-type uprising, but most of those members started to realize there was no hope. And a lot of people wonder, why can't you escape from the ghetto? Why couldn't you escape? Well, it would be easy to escape the ghetto. It would be easy. The hard part was to go anywhere for two reasons. Reason number one is everybody in the area were hostile to the Jews. They were either anti-Semitic or more anti-Semitic, and they would turn you into the Germans for no reward. And the second problem is the Germans had collective retribution. If they catch you outside the ghetto and you clearly escape, they're going to kill everybody you live with. They're going to kill every member of your family. They're going to kill everybody who knows you. So who can live with that? So what happened is the partisans, when the Germans were starting to close off the ghetto, they weren't letting the Jews out for their work parties anymore. So the Jews realized that the time was coming to an end. Ava Kovner wanted to have a all-out battle like they had already done in Warsaw, and he figures, let's just die with dignity. A lot of the other members said we can make a difference going out to the forest, and that's what they ultimately did. 150 members of the underground got out to the forest about 24 miles away from Vilna. The last 75 crawled 4 to 6 hours through the sewers to get out of the Vilna ghetto and got to the Rudniki Forest, where they became the nucleus of the partisans of Vilna in the Rudniki Forest.
Now, was it your father's story or someone else's story in the book that they lined Jews up by the thousands in these pits and shot them?
Right.
And just these mass graves,
right,
of people.
That was, the shooting was done by the Lithuanians, not the Germans.
Right.
They don't get as much credit. You know, the Germans, to their credit, at least acknowledge what they did, and they've tried to make retributions where, I don't want to get political, but the Lithuanians, you know, are very much in denial about their history, and they just want to kind of move on.
You don't want them to move on. You want them to acknowledge what they did.
Well, there's a lot of politics going on with it. The Lithuanians want to come in to the EU, and they want to move away from their Soviet era, times. But in my personal opinion, you know, they know what the history is, but you can't deny the history and think that the history doesn't exist.
So now, how did your parents get into the forest?
8 days before the ghetto was liquidated, one of the members of their underground group bribed a Lithuanian to get him a truck, and about 15 members escaped. See, it was easy to get out of the ghetto, but then where do you go without getting killed and turned in and having retribution? So what happened is they bribed a Lithuanian to get them a truck, and about 15 members got to the outskirts of Vilna, and then they walked all night to get to the Rudniki Forest.
And once they were there in that forest and the war was still on, they fought for those 4 years.
Well, it was actually a year. They were only there a year. What happened is when they got to the forest, the four things they need to do.
That's right. It was after the Warsaw Ghetto, which is from 43.
Right. The four things they need to do is, the first thing is shelter, because the Baltic winters, they can be 30, 40 below, and you can't live. So the first thing they did is they dug out bunkers, and they lined them with young trees. So at least they would have some kind of warmth and some kind of shelter. And that was the first thing they did. The second thing they did is they figured out food. What are they going to do for food? And there was the forest they were at was one of the largest forests that you can imagine. The whole area is 1,500 miles in area. It's enormous, but there's not really a lot of food there. So they only had the Russian partisans that were already out there weren't going to give them any food. And so they either basically don't eat, which they did many times for days, or they had a concoction that you and I wouldn't want to have. It was called Belanda. What it was is boiled swamp water with flour, because there's a lot of swamps out there. Or the third thing is they stole and robbed from all the local villagers and farmers, and they did a combination of the three. They didn't eat. They ate stuff you and I wouldn't want to eat, and they stole. The next thing they had to do is arms. The 150 members came out with 40 weapons, 40. They're not going to stop the Germans with 40 weapons. So what they had, and the Russians were armed to the teeth, but they wouldn't give them any weapons. So unless they had something to trade them. So then what they had to do is they had to go start stealing weapons and getting weapons any way they could get them and come up with stuff they could trade the Russians. And little by little, they came up with more weapons. Then they had to figure out, what are we going to do? They, to the man and woman, and they were about one-third women and two-third men, they felt that they were all going to die. So they were there for the honor of their family, to fight for the honor of their family and the dignity of the Jewish people. And they figured, we're going to die, so let's just die doing something. So the first thing they did is they went out and they started sawing communication poles between the whole area. They had, ultimately, they knocked off 350 of them. Then what they started doing is they had somebody who was really sophisticated in building mines and stuff. So they started derailing trains and ultimately blowing up trains. And then they blew up 5 bridges and water towers, military installations. And this is I'm just giving you the statistics of the partisans of Vilna, the Avengers group, which is 108 members. They killed 212 Germans because they used to keep track because they figure we're going to leave a log. We're going to probably be dead. They blew up numerous trains. And one of the partisans in Israel was telling me that it was really a joy to blow up a train and then immediately run for the forest and then listen to what happened next. And then I said to him, what does that mean? He goes, if you heard a lot of shooting, that means you blew up or derailed a troop train. If you heard secondary explosion, it was a weapon train. If you hear major smoke, it was a fuel train. But every time, and they derailed 350 trains from the east-west line, and every time, how many hours did it stop the transport to the eastern front? How many people were killed? Nobody knows. But these people fought for the honor and the dignity of the Jewish people.
So tell me where this ended up for you. I mean, what did this research into the Jewish partisans who fought the Germans, rather than going peacefully to a concentration camp or being lined up and shot, what did it take you? What has it done for Michael Bart?
Me personally?
Yes.
Well, to be honest with you, growing up, I didn't tell people my parents were Holocaust survivors. I just didn't. I blocked it out. I remember when the movie Schindler's List came out, my wife wanted to go see it. And I go, I don't watch Holocaust films because I didn't want much to do with the Holocaust. I didn't want to think. I didn't want to read. I didn't want to watch. My parents didn't talk very much. If they wanted, I'd listen. And it was something I blocked out. When my research energized me, and it really, really made me proud of my heritage. It made me proud of my parents. It made me proud of all the resistance and partisan fighters. And it made me with great sadness of what happened to the beautiful city of Vilna.
And did it change at all? Well, A, I wonder what it did to your further understanding of who your parents were, A. And B, did it change you at all in terms of how you look at the world I perceive things since
you
wrote this.
It's an interesting story. During my research, and I knew my parents were partisans, but you know, you can't really, until you see something and you can't, or touch something, you don't really understand. My wife and I were up at the Simon Wiesenthal Center up in Los Angeles and working with an archivist who somebody had died and left him boxes of pictures and documents from Vilna. And they said, you know, I'm willing to go through and see if there's anything that'll help you. So we're going through photo after photo, document, and getting nowhere, and just taking hours. And I was hungry and I wanted to leave. My wife's more patient than me. You know, she thought, you know, let's just keep doing it. The lady said, the archivist, we have one more box if you want to see it. And I'm thinking, oh, my wife's going, yes, we'll see it. So we're going through photo after photo, and I get to just about the bottom of the box. Mm-hmm. And I see this big photo of a bunch of, look like soldiers or partisans with guns. And I recognize Ava Kovner in the middle of the photo because he has a really distinct look. And then all of a sudden, I look to the right, and I see my mother and my father holding rifles. And that's actually the cover of our book, the photo on the cover. When I saw that, I was not only was I speechless, but it really takes you start to really understand what they kind of went through. You know, as far as what it did for me, I realized that was a time of madness, what was going on during the war. I don't hold grudges against people or countries. I judge people by their actions. I'm definitely, I think basically like what I said before, what it really left me is it really left me a lot more proud of my heritage. And it's kind of like I didn't want to, you know, advertise I was a child of survivors. Maybe, you know, now to me it's a badge of honor.
Well, this has been wonderful. Michael Bart, I'm glad you wrote this book. I mean, you brought us a piece of our history that we need to know about. I mean, human history.
Thank you.
Not just Jewish history.
Thank you.
Michael Bart, Until Our Last Breath, A Holocaust Story of Love and Partisan Resistance.